From the beginning of his term, President Trump's relationship with the Department of Justice has been anything but traditional. We're asking if that legacy is long-lasting with former Acting Attorney General Stuart Gerson. That's our start today on Monday, December 7th on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico comes to a sad and sudden retirement. We'll talk to a scientist who worked at the site who says it's like losing a friend.
I love astronomy and going to that place and going to the library and looking at so much astronomy, recent research. That was amazing. That was an inspiration.
And finally, in these wild and uncertain times, is there anything better than a good lullaby?
Singing lullabies soothe not just the baby, but also the caregiver. Stress levels are dropping not just for the baby, but also for the mother.
Why lullabies matter across cultures, you're telling us, and singing to us anyway. The Department of Justice has undergone a radical transformation in the Trump era. Over the past 4 years, President Trump has repeatedly blurred the lines between the Department of Justice and the White House, from his meddling into investigations in Russia's election interference, to clashing with the department on the travel ban for Muslim-majority countries, to fast-tracking federal executions, and more. The president has also clashed publicly with former FBI Director James Comey, current FBI Director Christopher Wray, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller. But now, President Trump is clashing with someone who's been a true loyalist to Trump's political goals, Attorney General Bill Barr. Barr is at odds with the president after stating that the 2020 presidential election showed no evidence of widespread voter fraud. But with just 44 days left in the Trump administration, loyalists to President Trump are going after Barr, and the New York Times is reporting that Barr is considering resigning before the end of his term. I'm joined now by Stuart Gerson, a partner at Epstein Becker Green and former Assistant Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush and former Acting Attorney General for the first 4 months of the Clinton administration. Stuart, great to have you with us.
Enjoy being on.
And Katie Benner is a reporter covering the Justice Department for the New York Times. Katie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Stuart, based on what we've seen this week, how would you categorize the relationship between Barr and Trump?
Well, you need to understand something. I mean, even in your little trailer at the beginning, it views Barr as something of a tool of the president. I think you need to look at it the other way around. President Trump has a Ptolemaic view of the universe. He doesn't see much besides himself, but he's not very intelligent. He has no philosophy, no ideas, but he benefits from having somebody who does, who acts in a way consistent with what Trump would like to accomplish. Bill Barr is vastly more intelligent than President Trump. He has a philosophy, a view of the way things are, believes in an almost natural law, hierarchical, top-down, authoritarian view of government to protect the people who have gone morally astray. He's given speeches to this effect. And he's able to advance that position, which has always been his position, because it's advantageous to Donald Trump. So in some sense, Trump is the tail and Barr is the dog. And that's why I think Katie's very useful reporting over the weekend makes sense.
Katie, let's talk about that, because the Times is reporting that Bill Barr could step down before the official end of the Trump administration. Where does that stand?
You know, that's correct. I'm told that his thinking on it is changing pretty much day to day and hour to hour. But at the end of the day, he really feels like there's not much left for him to do at the department. He's come in to do what he felt was necessary. When he would say writing the relationship between the White House and the Justice Department was a very important priority. And really looking into what he thought of as an abuse of power by the FBI in investigating Donald Trump was another one of his goals, which he did do. Now, as Stuart says, some people interpreted this as the president pressuring Bill Barr to take these actions. But in fact, I agree with Stuart. I think that Barr himself felt these things were necessary, and that now that he's done them, there's really not much reason for him to continue to stay, given that Trump has lost the election.
Stuart, you worked with Bill Barr during the President George H.W. Bush administration. How did what you're seeing under this administration compare to what you saw then?
Well, the difference is the president. George H.W. Bush was one of the most experienced people ever to assume the presidency. He had a view of the way government worked, the relationship between the government and the people, and where the people who worked for him fit into things. The broad agenda that Bill Barr has been able to advance under President Trump was not a viable agenda under President Bush. And that's the difference. Barr has not changed his view of things. And understand that, I mean, Barr in many ways is a doctrinaire conservative, and indeed as am I. I mean, we probably agree on most things in the world, except the relationship between the government and the people and what democracy means and what separation of powers means in order to keep us free.
Stuart, would you say in that sense that Attorney General Barr was more political under President Trump?
Well, I don't know what you mean by political. I think he is advancing an agenda that he has and using whatever means are available. So,
what I mean by political, I guess, is when his response to the Mueller investigation, which found that there were, you know, some dealings between President Trump and Russia, and that Bill Barr essentially took President Trump's side, and many folks said that was being political. And there were other examples of that.
You've anticipated what I was going to get to, which is the Mueller report is a good example. You'll recall that Barr furnished what many of us call an application for employment with a 19-page memorandum gratuitously submitted to the administration denouncing the Mueller investigation. So you can view it as political in the sense that Barr quibbled his way through the Mueller report, misrepresenting key aspects of what the Mueller report did and did not do. But also you can look at it in the philosophical sense that Barr believes that, in a sense, the president can do no wrong since he's the head of the executive branch. There's nothing in the executive branch that can be brought to bear on him while he's the president. If you want to view that as political, yes, indeed, that's political. If you want to view it as something else, that's fine, too. The net of it is, though, that the public was misled that the rule of law was diminished.
Katie, based on what Stuart is saying right there, I mean, were there other unprecedented or similarly political, if you will, in quotes, moves by Bill Barr as he served as attorney general that might stand out, that were different from previous attorneys general?
I think certainly at least twice he's intervened in different cases that would have benefited the president's allies. So reducing the sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone, President Trump's longtime friend, and then asking the courts to please withdraw the prosecution against Michael Flynn, President Trump's first national security advisor. These are things that we know about and that the department inside the department was really roiled when they happened. I think that it's very unusual to see people inside the department criticize the attorney general. That is something that very rarely happens, especially to reporters, and it's happening all the time now. But even more unusual, we saw career prosecutors write letters to the editor in Seattle, in Boston, in San Diego, and here in Washington, D.C., saying that they feel that the attorney general has run the department in a way that's irresponsible and in a way that undermines one of the things they have felt was the most important about working for the Justice Department, which is an independence from the White House that allowed it to credibly say, we prosecute everybody fairly without fear or favor. Now, I think it's a little bit naive to say that everybody's always believed that. I think when you look at the long history of criminal justice in the United States, certainly there are people, especially in some, you know, African-American communities, who would say they've never really felt that that was true. But it's a goal and it's something that we strive toward, is what people inside the department would say. And that by having an attorney general who sits at the top and takes actions that seemingly obliterate that in the favor of the president, it sends a message that now we really, really do not have that kind of even-handed sense of justice, nor does it matter.
Stuart, to Katie's point, I mean, there are many Americans who say, particularly Americans of color, Black Americans, poor Americans, who would say that the Justice Department really doesn't have their interests at heart. But at least in terms of the way we think about the Justice Department, has that been altered under President Bill Barr? I'm sorry, under Attorney General Bill Barr in the Trump administration?
Well, I think it has. And what Katie describes, in my view, is quite accurate, which there was always an understanding, particularly in the United States attorney's offices like the Southern District of New York and the District of Columbia and elsewhere, the major offices, that there would be independence and that people with long experience, career people, would be able to make judgments that would be backed up by their superiors, not as a rubber stamp, but dispassionately from any political interest that a given administration might have. And this is a departure from that. Katie is absolutely right about that. And there are other circumstances. An attorney general getting involved in what was essentially a military operation at Lafayette Square. Again, consistent with Barr's view about what he thinks is the universal power of the executive as commander in chief and head of the executive branch to overcome barriers by the other two branches. The sentencings that Katie noted are a good example of that. But the legislature as well. You know, I'm one of the lead counsel in one of the big border wall cases, and there's a place where the president, with the support of the attorney general, invaded legislative appropriations powers, the powers of the purse. Ultimately, I think the Biden administration is going to moot all of that, but we have this matter before the Supreme Court, and we're arguing conservative principles against what styles itself as a conservative administration with the attorney general's support.
Katie, mentioning President-elect Joe Biden taking office, as Stuart just mentioned, do we have a sense for what that Justice Department might look like under a Biden presidency? Do we know who might be at the top right now?
Starting with who might be at the top, I think that we're looking at almost a runoff between Sally Gates, the former deputy attorney general, and Doug Jones, former senator. What we're seeing is a lot of support for Gates. We know that Joe Biden really, really likes her, but because of her involvement in the early days of the Russia investigation and the investigation into Michael Flynn, there is a fear that Republicans might be hesitant to confirm her or might want to turn her into a confirmation fight. That said, she's incredibly qualified. She has really, really strong national security chops. She is a former prosecutor, and she has a really deep commitment to civil rights issues as well. So there are a lot of people who are still quietly supporting her. Doug Jones, another person who Joe Biden just very personally likes, and as we can see from all of his cabinet picks, that matters a lot. Again, a good civil rights record, but there is a hesitance to say, do we want a cabinet that seems to be dominated by white men, which is what we're seeing with several of the picks. There have been exceptions, for example, with HHS and DHS, but Justice Department is so unusual right now. The way that it has been transformed under the Trump administration seems to some people to be so extreme, especially on questions of civil rights, on questions of who to protect in this country. You know, there was a really strong shift away from protecting the rights of minorities, protecting the rights of LGBTQ citizens, to protecting the rights of, you know, religious groups of Christians who don't want to serve gay lesbian patrons, for example, moving away, trying to strike down affirmative action. The really strong support of police rather than protesters in this, you know, long summer and fall and now winter of these cries for social justice around the treatment of African Americans. Is a white man at the top of the Justice Department the person to send the message that the Biden administration will want to send, which is, we are going to reverse those things, you know, as priorities and as positions. And broadly speaking, we want to reverse those things.
Stuart, what do you say are some of the challenges that face the Biden administration, given what the Trump administration and Barr's legacy has been so far?
Well, Katie talked about a number of potential initiatives, and I certainly would concur with her on many of them, if not most of them. But the question is how to bring it about. I'm an old guy. I was in the Justice Department during Watergate and, in fact, litigated the very first Watergate-related case before the special prosecutor was appointed. And I remember after the Saturday Night Massacre, the disarray that there was in the Justice Department, and it in many ways bears comparability to what we're seeing today. The attorney general choice by President Ford then became very important, and the person who came in was Ed Levy, one of the greatest attorney generals of all time. And he was able to create reforms within the building and within the Department of Justice to aid transparency, restore integrity, and we need that now. So that the idea of reversing different things that the Trump administration might have done or might be perceived as doing is on the agenda, but you have to get it done. And you need to have the building behind you if you're the attorney general. I know that from personal experience. And getting the building behind you means using the resources apolitically of the highly qualified, dedicated people that pledge their careers to the Department of Justice as the servants of the people, not of a particular president.
Stuart, to that point, I mean, what does the Justice Department look like internally these days? We know that there have been so many departments across Washington that have been gutted, or where positions haven't been filled, or career service folk have left. What's the feeling inside the DOJ today? Do we know?
Well, I mean, Katie talked earlier about the fact that there are the sorts of people who don't usually talk to reporters about the people to whom they report who are talking to her and her colleagues throughout the media. So, you know, there's a great deal of discontent. I hear it also, of course. I still have a lot of friends and associates who are in or affiliated with the department or who have left it in recent times. You know, I'm one of the founders of a group called Checks and Balances, which are all right of center people, most of whom have been in the Justice Department at one time or another, and who have become a sounding board for a lot of these complaints. I mean, there are important positions that are unfilled or being filled by acting people, and that's true throughout the government. There are some real issues involving preparedness for national security. I mean, one of the most damaging things that has occurred in the Barr administration was his given declassification authority, which utterly undermines legitimate interests of the intelligence community and really threatens the integrity not of people in the Justice Department, but of analysts throughout the IC. And these are things that need to be reversed, and that the right reporting relationships and responsibilities need to be redefined, irrespective of the fact that there are programs to change, positions in court to alter and the like of that, revivifying the Civil Rights Division, which was mentioned earlier. There are a bunch of things that need to be done, but you need to have the organization and the leadership and the dedication to principle that has been eroded in this administration. There's a very helpful report that listeners might want to download from the University of Pennsylvania Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law, which over 250 some odd pages discusses many of these issues. And we know that people are reading our report, and one hopes that the Biden administration can do these structural things to enable not just the effective establishment of new programs or the reversal of bad old ones, but the respect of the people, the durability of the law, that people will respect the law and act according to it.
Speaking of respect for the law, Katie, I want to get your thoughts on this, because one thing that outgoing presidents do is often use their pardon power. We've seen a lot of interest in President Trump in terms of pardoning, for example, retired General Michael Flynn, who was Trump's national security advisor. There is talk of preemptive presidential pardons for Trump's children and Rudy Giuliani. And there's even been talk of reports of potential bribery, including the presidential pardon process. Where does all of that stand? We've got about 2 minutes to go.
Sure. You're right that there's a lot of interest in pardons right now. It is within Donald Trump's powers to pardon people. So he is not trying to usurp powers that are not usually given to the president. I think people would argue that he's trying to use them a little bit unusually, and that because of the way he's run the White House, there was a sense early on in his administration, in the case that you referenced, that people felt that if they donated to the Republican Party or donated to something that Donald Trump cared about, they could get a pardon. As we know, that would be illegal. But certainly that is the sort of atmosphere that I think people would argue that the president has created around his use of powers generally and his use of the pardon power specifically. And so while he does have the power to pardon, I think that what we will also see is that he is going to use that power in ways that will cause a hue and cry and be considered very unusual, if not crossing an ethical line, because that is really in keeping with his presidency overall.
Stuart, does that sound about right to you?
Well, the president has the power, and he has the ability to abuse that power. That will be part of his very unfortunate legacy with regard to the administration of justice and the rule of law. He has crossed the line with respect to both the judiciary and the legislature, and he's acted in an arbitrary, almost dictatorial way. That's what you'll read about.
There are still a number of Trump associates, Stuart, who are either facing or could face federal charges. Could they be pardoned by the president in the coming days and weeks and completely not have to face those charges?
Well, it is possible. I mean, the president's pardon power is very broad. We've seen that not just in this administration, but in previous administrations, including Obama and Clinton. So it's really hard to know what the extent of it is. The Flynn pardon is already subject to criticism as pertaining to acts that have not yet taken place, that he's being pardoned infinitely into the future. And there's a question as to whether that would be a legitimate thing to do. But in terms of matters that are known that involve Trump associates, children, family, and the like of that, the president likely does have the power to pardon them. And the question with regard to that, and even the president's hypothetical pardoning of himself, is how do you test it? It would take a prosecutorial act in a subsequent administration to occur, and then the subject individual challenging that pardon. So I don't know what this president is going to do, and indeed he might not even know what he's going to do from minute to minute. But how it would be tested and adjudicated is hard to know. What this president does with regard to the pardon, particularly with regard to the hypothetical self-pardon, is very different from how the framers of the Constitution understood the multi-hundred-year history of pardons in English law. It was designed to protect an active president and not to extend to things in the far distant future that were of an unknown nature, particularly with regard to a self-pardon.
Well, and that's really one of the questions I have, too, is that the president himself is facing what could be criminal charges for so many things when he gets out of office. Would the pardon extend to that as well? I mean, he's been, you know, in the crosshairs in many ways of the New York State Attorney General for a while, among others.
Remember now that the president's pardon power extends only to matters of federal law. So that whatever Letitia James is doing as the Attorney General of New York or Cy Vance is doing as the District Attorney for Manhattan have nothing to do with the pardon power. And those investigations with regard to taxes, evaluation of real estate properties and the like of that, those can continue to whatever end that they take, as long as those individuals who are leading those offices stay in office. So the president can't protect himself from that. And it's only federal matters. Now, I would expect that, as was the case with President Nixon, that it would not be the intention of a soon-to-be President Biden to seek the prosecution of his predecessor. It looks too much like what happens in banana republics. So I think that that's unlikely. But with respect to others who might have committed cognizable crimes, we just don't know. If people were injured financially or otherwise by some of this conduct, it may well be that we're going to see cases. I tend to doubt it, but it's entirely possible. But the thing to keep in mind, given your question, is that none of this will protect the president from state-based or municipal-based investigations or prosecution.
We'll be paying close attention. Katie Benner is a reporter covering the Justice Department for the New York Times, and Stuart Gerson is former Assistant Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush and former Acting Attorney General for the Clinton administration. Stuart, Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take a listen to this. The sound of a tragic cosmic ending. That's the sound of the iconic telescope at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico collapsing to the ground last week. Carlos Perez filmed the collapse from the observatory's control room. And the collapse didn't come as a surprise. Two of the cables supporting the telescope broke earlier this year, prompting the National Science Foundation to call for decommissioning the 900-ton instrument. Luckily, there were no deaths or injuries, but many who were inspired by the telescope are mourning a major loss for the scientific community in Puerto Rico and around the world. Joining me now is Abel Mendez, Associate Professor of Physics and Astrobiology at the University of Puerto Rico at Arecibo. Abel has done research using the telescope at the Arecibo Observatory for the past decade. Abel, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tanzina.
My family is partly from Barceloneta, which is not far from Arecibo. This observatory has been such an iconic part of Puerto Rico for so long. When you heard about the final collapse, what did it mean for you?
The collapse was about 7 5:55 a.m. local time in Puerto Rico. I just got a message from a colleague through phone about 8 a.m., just 5 minutes after the collapse. And then suddenly I got a request for interviews from everywhere, and I had to decline them. It was struggling with the moment, and it was hard for me to speak everywhere, even listening to the sound of the collapse, as you put at the beginning, is hard.
You've worked with this observatory for so many years. Tell me a little bit about the work and the importance of the telescope.
Yes, I studied the possibility of life elsewhere beyond Earth, and I used the observatory to study stars with no potentially habitable planets. I am not looking with the observatory for any signs of life, but I'm using to study stars which are known to have these planets. My last time that I used the observatory was about August 6th. That was a Thursday. And the first cable failure was on August 10th. And at that moment, I was not that concerned because it was just one cable and the other cables were supposed to withstand the weight. But then on November 6th, there was a second cable, and that's I knew at that moment that this is not going good.
You visited the telescope for the first time when you were just 12 years old, and then you ended up working there. You said this was heartbreaking for you.
Definitely. So the observatory has been an inspiration for many students. And when I visited the observatory, I was overwhelmed with the magnitude of the place. No picture gives justice for the observatory. You have to be there and see how huge is everything, the scale. And for me, I love astronomy, and going to that place and going to the library and looking at so much astronomy, recent astronomy, recent research, that was amazing. That was an inspiration. And I'm glad and lucky that eventually I was able to use the observatory by my own.
Abel, what happened to the observatory?
We know that the first failure of the cable, it was an auxiliary cable, and that cable failed probably because a problem during manufacturing. So there's already an investigation. But the second cable was a main supporting cable, and that broke. And we don't know yet what was the cause of that, because that was supposed to withstand. Maybe this was accelerated in 2017 by Hurricane Maria. We have also earthquakes this year in January, but probably Maria was much stronger, was the fact. And all this, and we were waiting for the National Science Foundation, which is the federal agency that manages the observatory, just to allow the repairs. But they were very cautious that we had to go very slowly because life are at stake if we were trying to repair. Probably that was too slow.
What were some of the telescope's key achievements for those who aren't as familiar with it?
Well, the Arecibo Observatory is no longer the biggest radio telescope, as everybody knows, because there is a bigger one in China. However, most radio telescopes can only receive radio signals. Arecibo can also transmit as a radar too. That's why in 1974, it was able to transmit a message to the stars, what is famously known as the Arecibo message. That's something that only radar types radio telescope can do. The Arecibo is still the best instrument, or was the best instrument in the world, to study the properties of trajectory of any potentially hazardous asteroid. That's why radar is important. There are many achievements also, and one that is related to my work. In 1992, detected the first exoplanet, the first planets around other stars.
Abel, what is going to happen? What's the future of the Arecibo Observatory right now? I know that there was a Twitter account that was trying to get people to save it. I mean, this feels like it's also a loss for the broader scientific community.
Yes, before the collapse, we were trying to save the observatory and to be fixed on time, but it took too long. And now we focus on rebuilding the observatory. So that's a big possibility. We know it will take time. At least the facilities around the observatory will be useful. And they have other instruments, scientific instruments, like a LIDAR to study the atmospheres. They have a small dish over there, 12-meter radio telescope. And they have a visitor center. So those areas will be still be operational, and the scientists there could do some work. But they will have the big instrument. And we are planning, and we are the scientific community and the users of the Arecibo Observatory are trying to propose a new telescope that might cost about $300 to $400 million.
And the funding for that would come from the National Science Foundation, or from Puerto Rico, or from where? What would it, how would it work?
Okay, National Science Foundation was supporting the observatory, but since 2006, it started to reduce the funding for the observatory. So we don't know now if NSF will be willing to take the observatory since that record. But it could be NSF, it could be any other federal agency that we will go directly to the Congress when we have all the plans, and then try to support the Congress. And from there, they will decide which will be the best agency to continue operating the observatory. I know Puerto Rico will also get involved, but most of the funding will be federal funding.
Are you optimistic with the Joe Biden administration that that federal funding will happen?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think this administration will do a good job supporting science everywhere.
Abel Mendez is an associate professor of physics and astrobiology at the University of Puerto Rico at Arecibo. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tansina.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Rock-a-bye, baby.
Classic lullabies are recognizable immediately, and it might be easy to dismiss these as merely simple children's bedtime songs, but there's actually a lot more depth and significance to these melodies than there may appear at first listen. Hannah Reyes Morales is a National Geographic photographer who's been researching lullabies. Her article on the subject, Songs to Soothe, is featured in the December issue of National Geographic magazine. And Hannah and her colleague Rupert Compston traveled around the world recording lullabies and learning what they mean to the caregivers singing them and the children hearing them. This is what one lullaby sounds like in Liberia.
Sleep, baby, sleep. Sleep, baby, sleep. Mama want to see you sleepy. Sleep, baby, sleep.
Here's another from Mongolia.
Хосте хорте одоронгош хуслин цинхэр шонаси.
And finally, the Philippines.
Ikaw na pala ang may-ari ng damdamin na minamahal ko.
These lullabies all have different sounds, but they have many things in common, including the ability to provide emotionally safe spaces for parents and children, to remind immigrants and refugees of home, or to create deep and meaningful connections between people and cultures, even when miles apart. From Syrian refugees living in Turkey to frontline healthcare workers estranged from their family during the pandemic here in the United States, Hannah told us she witnessed firsthand the power and impact lullabies can have. And her own interest in this research emerged after the first time she sang a lullaby to her stepson.
He was sleeping over in our new place in the city, which was a bit far from where he lived with his mom, and he was sleeping over for the first time in that space. And it was the middle of the night, it was like about 2 or 3 a.m., and he started crying. And I started panicking, and I started getting worried. And then, you know, in the midst of sort of like my panic about what to do about a crying child, I started to hold him, and I started to sing. And then eventually, you know, he fell asleep. And then I guess in that moment, I started to ask myself, you know, whose fears had I really been assuaging in that time? Or was it just about as much as my own fears that I had been assuaging? And so I started just casually asking people about their experiences of bedtime, their experiences of what were the things that frightened and also reassured them growing up. And I realized how there were just so many different stories in that space that, you know, it's one of our most intimate of spaces. And that's when I really started delving into the sort of like this hidden world of lullabies.
So Hannah, I confessed to you before this interview that I have a 10-month-old son and I don't sing him lullabies, but I do have a bedtime ritual that is very sort of rhythmic and, you know, and almost, I guess, somewhat melodic, even though it's not a traditional lullaby. So what is a lullaby? Can it be anything that we say or sing to a child when we put them to bed?
Well, so at least the way we approached this story was I was more interested in sort of the more general view of nighttime rituals. And so our working definition of a lullaby was very, very broad. When I think about lullabies, I even think about the nighttime sounds we hear and how different that is for everybody around the world. And that's sort of part of the fabric from which we start going off to sleep. One of the researchers I spoke to, Laura Sorelli, who, you know, studies the science behind maternal song, when I was interviewing her, she explained something to me that I thought was really powerful, where she looked at the lullaby not just as really the song, but she explained to me that in her research, she was looking at the lullaby as sort of this multimodal experience. It's really about feeling mother's gentle rocking, you know, having her face very close to the baby, and sort of feeling the warmth of the hold. So for me, that's sort of how I see the lullaby as well.
What's the history of lullabies? And I suspect that they're not just happening in the United States. I mean, this is a global phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a global phenomenon. It's not just something that happens, you know, across borders. It has also happened through the course of history and through the course of time. The oldest recorded lullaby that we have, or the oldest record of a complete lullaby that we know about, is this Babylonian lullaby that's about 4,000 years old. So we're looking at lullaby singing. We've been doing this for millennia. One of the really cool things about it is that it's been passed on for generations, and, you know, mostly by women. When I think of lullabies, I guess I think of my own mother, and I think about what she passed on to me through lullaby singing. And I guess, you know, one of the things that as a woman, I always thought about was when I read history books, I am likely looking at history books through the lens of men. And then when I think about lullabies, I was thinking about how much history there is likely composed by women.
Why are they so soothing to children in particular? I mean, there have been studies from the Harvard Music Lab that found that infants who listened to lullabies that weren't even in their own language and not even from their caregivers were still soothed by them. I find that fascinating.
Another thing that Laura Sorelli, the researcher I had mentioned earlier to you, had explained to me was she had this term called infant-directed singing. And often, you know, infants will know when an adult or a caregiver is specifically directing sound or music to them. One of the things that Samuel Mayer, who's part of the Harvard Music Lab that you mentioned, told me that the interesting thing about lullabies as well is while, you know, music is so diverse across cultures, across different backgrounds, that the interesting thing about lullabies is that we as human beings, when we're singing a lullaby, we're looking at the same set of constraints. You know, you have to put a child to sleep. So in that way, my guess is that we're instinctively maybe slowing down the tempo, you know, singing in a more intentionally soothing way.
Hannah, I want to pause for a second and play you some of our listeners, because we put this question out to them, because we put this question out to them about what lullabies made a difference in their lives. And we asked them to sing us some of them as well. Take a listen.
My name is Stephanie Hansford, and I'm calling from Port St. John, Florida. When I was a child, my mom sang a song to me. Little boxes, little boxes, little boxes full of ticky-tacky, and they all had little boxes, little boxes. And I can't sing anymore because I'm going to cry.
I am singing the lullaby that my mother sang to me after our parents divorced, and I was a 5, 6, 7-year-old. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy over the love of you. That song helped me feel secure at a heart level. I sing it to our two adopted sons for the same reason.
Hi, this is Diana from Edwardsville. And as a Colombian American, my lullabies were in Spanish. The most popular one was Los Pollitos, or the Little Chickies, which goes like this. Los pollitos dicen pío, 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 cuando tienen hambre, cuando tienen frío. It keeps on going, but it is very much a part of my wonderful childhood memories.
And Hannah's work inspired me to start singing more lullabies to my 10-month-old son, like this one that my mother sang to me. Qué linda manita que tiene mi bebé. Qué linda, qué buena, qué bonita es. And of course, there are more lyrics to that. What do we know about the one of the most well-known lullabies in the United States, Rockabye Baby? Because it's almost a little bit like some of our fairy tales, right? It's not exactly, I mean, when you listen to the words, it's a little scary.
Right. That's one of the interesting things that I found while I was researching this lullaby story, as well as when I was speaking to moms and actually listening to lullabies on the field, was how dark lullabies actually are, or how dark they can be. You know, the lyrics are frequently quite macabre. And, you know, Rockabye Baby is about a cradle falling from the treetop. And so, you know, I was thinking about that. And I think because a baby doesn't necessarily understand the language, they're getting the soothingness, I guess, from more the rhythm of the music, the way we express it. But the lyrics of the lullaby are understood by the caregiver. And the way I saw it was that at the end of the day, it's a way for a caregiver to sort of express what's in their heart. And often that includes our fears. The baby falling from the treetop could be many different things, of course, but just that fear of loss being expressed in this sort of very precious moment. And so for me, that's also one of the things that interested me so much about lullabies, was how grim the content often was. But towards the end of the story, maybe one of the most surprising revelations to me, at the end of it, we're using these fears to forge our reassurances, you know, to forge ways to soothe ourselves. And it's not just the baby being soothed. There's been studies that singing lullabies soothe not just the baby, but also the caregiver. Stress levels are dropping not just for the baby, but also for the mother.
Speaking of stressful situations, I mean, you have spent time talking to people who are living in you know, disproportionately stressful environments, dangerous environments around the world. You've spoken to Syrian refugees who are living in Turkey about lullabies. What have those lullabies meant in really precarious and dangerous situations?
Right. So for me, I mean, I've always, in the broader context of my work and not just the story, I've always been very, very interested in safer space making. I've always been interested, you know, one of the things that I also sort of had before I did the story was I was covering the war on drugs in the Philippines, and I witnessed families singing lullabies to babies amidst very harmful environments, sometimes amidst gunfire. And I always felt like that was a really powerful moment, that in these spaces of high harm, in these spaces of high threat, that we as human beings, we still manage to find ways to keep each other safe. And the way I saw the lullaby was that was part of the fabric in which we create these safe spaces often. For Syrian refugees in particular, I was speaking with the Carnegie Lullaby Project. They link up teaching artists, they link up professional musicians with different mothers. And one of their projects was working with refugee moms, and collaborators for the project describe lullabies as portable sanctuaries, these things that you can take with you anywhere you go. And we saw that when we were reporting on the field. You know, we saw how lullabies were crossing borders. A lot of the women that we met, the Syrian women that we met, were singing lullabies from Syria to children who hadn't been to Syria. And a few of them were telling us how it made them feel as if they were making a way for the child to have a connection to a place that they're from, but a place that they had never been to. And we've also seen sort of like lullabies evolve as the stories of people change. One of the refugee mothers that we met, Khadija, she used to sing just these wonderful, sweet lullabies to her eldest son. But after the conflict escalated and after they were displaced into Turkey, she started singing lullabies to her youngest son, but they were lullabies about the war. And it was really poignant being there in the room as she did that. And I realized how within the lullabies that she sang are parts of herself and parts of her history and parts of her experience that her children will hopefully carry with them as they grow up.
You also spoke to healthcare workers in Massachusetts that, because of the pandemic, had to be quarantined from their family, and yet they used lullabies to connect with their children during that time. What was that like?
Right. So that was when our project really took a pivot. You know, we had all these places that we still wanted to go to and we had researched on, and then the pandemic happened and I found myself caught in Boston, where I'm not from. I'm from the Philippines. And so we started looking at how to sort of, well, one, we weren't sure that, of course, like, what do lullabies look like in the context of the pandemic was the question we were asking. And I guess I'd always seen lullabies and physical closeness as a way that we protect our children and protect each other. Part of keeping ourselves safe is being close. And of course, in the context of the pandemic, the way that healthcare workers who were working in COVID units were keeping their children and their families safe was to be physically distant from them and to isolate from them. And so while we met a lot of grandmothers who were very worried that lullabying wasn't happening anymore because of technology, we also saw how in this particular instance or in this particular case, you know, the technology was sort of bridging that distance and sort of providing an opportunity for people to connect amidst all these real challenges and this real challenging situation.
Hannah Reyes Morales is a National Geographic photographer who's been researching lullabies around the world. Her article on the subject, Songs to Soothe, is featured in the December issue of National Geographic magazine. Hannah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dinky-dink, skinnamarinky-doo. I love you, ba-doo-ba-doo.
All right, we're going to hear some more of your favorite lullabies and what they meant to you.
Hi, this is Daniel Creamer from Aurora, Colorado. I don't remember being sung many lullabies as a child, but I sing Golden Slumbers by the Beatles to my two-year-old as we fight for nap time over quarantine. Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby. Golden slumbers fill your eyes.
Thank you, and happy sleeping.
This is Erica Sands calling from Cary, North Carolina. And my daughter, who is 16 now, I made up a song for her. When she woke up every morning, I would sing, good morning, morning, morning to my pretty princess. Good morning, morning, morning to my pretty princess. Good morning, good morning, good morning.
My name is Evan from Rockton, Illinois. Lullabies were sung to me as a child, and I still sing them to my kids today. There is an old Lithuanian song that my mom was taught by her dad, and I passed on to my kids. It goes like this. Aš berenukis kaipon žukis kaipon mažo obalukis in a madagatis kaipon žadis pasko monte titi, which roughly translates to, I'm a little boy just like a goat, like an apple on a tree. All the little girls like little goats, so after me go tee, tee, tee. Obviously, I'm not sure that it got passed down correctly, but that's my story.
Hi, this is Anna from Stanford, Connecticut. I grew up in Queens, and my mom is Len, and she used to sing to me in Spanish. It would go something like, Aruru mi niña, aruru mi amor. I can't remember the rest, but that was how it went.
Hi, this is Marisa Johnston from Santa Cruz, California. I had a song that my parents used to sing to me. Lullaby and good night, little Marisa. Put your head on my shoulder and sleep through the night. When you wake in the morn, you will see the light. So good night, Marisa. So good night and sleep tight. I used to cry every time because I thought they made it up for me and they were saying goodbye to me every night. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Natalie, calling from Gresham, Oregon. Two of my sons have unfortunately already passed away. And now I find that I can no longer sing the lullaby, my sunshine, with the words, my only sunshine, to my four-year-old, because I feel like it's a heartbreaking betrayal to my other son. So I've changed the song to You Are My Sunshine, One of My Sunshines. And in that way, I am remembering all of my children. Thank you.
This is Elizabeth from St. Petersburg. And yes, my aunt used to sing me lullabies. And it's very special to me because when I saw her when she was in hospice, it was the last song she ever sang to me. It goes like this. Rock-a-bye, baby, in the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. And down will come, baby, cradle and all.
Hi, I'm Faye Visconti from Altaloma, California. And my favorite lullaby goes like this. Sing a song of lyra, pocket full of basta, 24 blackbirds baked in a gujata. When the gooch was open, the birds began to sing. Now wasn't that a dandy thing to set before the king? The king was in the parlor rolling ravioli. The queen was in the pantry boiling muscacholi. The maid was in the garden picking basilico. Along a come a black a bird and bit off of your nose. And the reason why we love that is because it's a symbol for our Bologna family, a hybrid of Sicilian and American culture.
My name is Michael Goldstein. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. My mom sang to me almost every night a song with words. The melody was Green Sleeves, and here was her words. I love my Michael, he's so good. He's such a good little darling boy. I love my Michael, he's so good. He's such a sweet little boy. Michael, Michael, I love you. You're such a sweet little darling boy. Michael, Michael, I love you. You're such a good little boy. She sang that to me almost every night when I went to bed.
Hi, my name is Sarah Alexander. I live in Kirkland, Washington. When my son, who's now almost nine, was a baby, I used to sing Loch Lomond to him, which goes, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low, and I'll be in Scotland afore, and me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond.
Lullabies can also serve to bring comfort in incredibly difficult moments, like the one that our producer Lydia's sister sent us. And just a warning that this call deals with the loss of a child and will hit a lot of us hard, but we felt it was really important to hear.
I had my first son in June last year, and he was unexpectedly stillborn. My husband asked me to sing a lullaby at his burial, so after saying all of our goodbyes and lowering him into the ground, I sang this song. It's called Lakota Lullaby, and one of the lines means, "My kind-hearted boy, go to sleep." Chante washte hokshila, laki eshte ma, anhe peki washte, wahi ohiye, wahi ohiye. We named our son Sky, and now Sky has a little brother who is almost 4 months old. I sing this song to my son Rio too, and I hope that Sky is listening when I do. Sky and Rio may not get to grow up together, but I feel some comfort in knowing that at least they have this in common, that their mother sang this lullaby to both of them.
There's really nothing to say that can follow that moment. So I just want to thank you for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And we'll see you tomorrow.
I love you in the morning and in the afternoon. I love you in the evening underneath the moon. Cha-cha! Skinnamarinky-dinky-dink, skinnamarinky-doo. I love you, ba-doo-ba-doo-doo. I love you, Alice Boo. I love you.
Hug and a kiss?